This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymph. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert, and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakweowasan, we are all related. My special guest today is author and activist Starhawk, one of my mentors in nonviolence. I met Starhawk 10 years ago through her post-apocalyptic ecotopian novel, The Fifth Sacred Thing, and it changed my life. I identified strongly with Maya, the aging matriarch, who, like me, was born at the midpoint of the 20th century and was facing the end of her life with a boatload of concern about the tenuous future of her loved ones and her community. As an illustration of Starhawk's dry, understated sense of humor, I'll introduce her with the opening line from her newsletter of last weekend.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's Benjamin the Donkey.
Hi, Benji. I should have known you'd show up as soon as the subject of humor came up. Starhawk is living proof that you don't have to write limericks to be funny. Here's that opening line. Quote, "In just a few days, I'll be 66 years old. Maybe I should be retiring. But with the Arctic melting and a climate change denier in the White House, it doesn't seem like the moment to sit back and crochet Afghans."
Hee-haw, hee-haw, hee-haw.
I know, right? But like all great humor, it serves as window dressing to draw attention to a profound truth. It's the same truth that moves me to work so hard to keep delivering Sequitur to our small but influential following. Sharing our gifts with our community has never been more important.
You know, once you no longer sit on the fence, allusions to future events begin to look moot, no longer compute, and start making less and less sense. Yeehaw!
The sequel to The Fifth Sacred Thing, titled City of Refuge, was published last year. I'm proud to be the owner of an inscribed copy. Starhawk's works are also available as audiobooks.
You know, cannibal incivility is currently drugged instability. A shortage of food will change how it's viewed and give it more respectability. Hee-haw!
Benji, is nothing sacred to you?
You know, global warming is bad, okay? But with cannibal life on its way, it adds delicate char to long pork tartare for folks not already passé.
I guess not. You don't think there's an instinctive taboo against cannibalism like the incest taboo?
Yeehaw!
Well, it might interest you to know that there are allusions to cannibalism in Starhawk's writing, because you're right. When food becomes truly scarce, there's no telling what people might do. However, I would remind you that cannibalism doesn't have to be hostile or even violent. I'm reminded here of what we learned back in January when we studied the Wetiko psychosis about indigenous cultures that engage in the ritual eating of ancestors or enemies in order to preserve their power. Anyway, today I'm proud to present Sequitur Regeneration to celebrate Starhawk's birthday. I lifted that title directly from the part of her newsletter that explains what she is doing and why she is doing it. Quote, "Climate change is not just carbon. It represents massive ecosystem degeneration. And ecosystems include people, too. We need to respond with massive ecosystem and social regeneration. And that's why I spend so much time teaching our Earth Activist training, which combines ecological design with a grounding in spirit and a focus on activism and organizing."
You know, I'm trying to remove hopium from my life, but that doesn't mean I still don't have some hopes left. For example, I'm into this doomer thing deep, but there still are some hopes that I keep. Like before we all fry, I hope that I'll die quietly while I'm asleep. Yeehaw!
I don't think ecosystem and social regeneration is hopium. I think it's a sterling example of taking care of each other and this planet we call home in very challenging physical, spiritual, and political times. Starhawk is also the author of nonfiction works in pagan spirituality and social organization. I especially recommend her book titled The Empowerment Manual, A Guide for Collaborative Groups, which, besides the nuts and bolts of group process, treats the subject of privilege and power dynamics with great wisdom and compassion. I've never attended the Earth Activist training, and I'm eager to hear more about it. I have, however, met Starhawk in person on two occasions. The first was in late 2011 at a panel discussion in connection with Occupy Oakland, which was ostensibly a debate between proponents of nonviolence and proponents of diversity of tactics. My takeaway from that event was that diversity of tactics is not a euphemism for violence, nor does nonviolence mean the same thing as peace. A few months later, I attended a solo training by Starhawk at the Women's Building in San Francisco's Mission District. My next contact with Starhawk was a tarot reading by telephone in early 2013 as an expression of her gratitude for the significant donations I had made to both the Earth Activist Training and the Fifth Sacred Thing movie project after my mother died. Then she contacted me while she was working on City of Refuge to ask how I felt about her giving one of her characters my name. Well, I was honored. Not that the character is anything like me. Just for starters, it's a man. But that she would ask, and that she would send me an inscribed copy of the book. I mean, it's not like I've got a copyright on my name. Anyway, I edited the prologue to City of Refuge, titled Declaration of the Four Sacred Things, and I set it to the Sequitur theme music to submit in response to a call last year at this time for one-minute submissions for a birthday compilation for Starhawk from her supporters. I have used this clip as an invocation at sacred gatherings, and I share it now as an invocation for Sequitur regeneration. In company with cultures of many different times and places, we name these things as sacred: air, fire, water, and earth. Whether we see them as the breath, energy, blood, and body of the mother, or as the blessed gifts of a creator, or as symbols of the interconnected systems that sustain life, we know that nothing can live without them. To call these things sacred is to say that they have a value beyond their usefulness for human ends. All beings are part of the earth life, and so are sacred. Only ecological balance can sustain freedom. Only in freedom can that fifth sacred thing we call spirit flourish in its full diversity. To this, we dedicate our curiosity, our will, our courage, our silences, and our voices. To honor the sacred is to create conditions in which nourishment, sustenance, habitat, knowledge, freedom, and beauty can thrive. To honor the sacred is to make love possible.
So I want to start out at a very basic level with what is permaculture, what is the Earth Activist Training, I've read that it's a two-week program resulting in certification. What is that certification about? What does it entitle a participant to do or claim or be after they complete the program? Then a little bit more detail about this upcoming Earth Activist training itself, who's participating, who the trainers are, and things like that. And then we'll get on to your activist career in the second half of the interview, if we have time. Okay, it's all yours, Starhawk. Take it away.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be on and nice to be able to actually chat with you. And I wanted to start by talking about permaculture. Permaculture is a whole system of ecological design. It's based on the idea that if we actually look at nature, observe nature, listen to nature, understand how nature works, then we can use those same principles in designing human systems so that we can meet our needs while actually regenerating the environment around us instead of destroying it. And I think permaculture is a really crucial tool right now in this time of climate change, and especially in this political moment. All the scientists and all our observation of the Earth tells us this is an absolutely critical moment, not just for now, but for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years to come, for us to actually limit emissions and start doing something to turn this situation around. And instead, we have people on the highest levels trying as hard as they can to push us into using more and more fossil fuels, more and more coal, more and more destruction. So we need to counter that in so many different ways. And I think the gift of permaculture is that it teaches people to look at not just one solution here or one solution there, but how all those things fit together into systems and can be applied as systems so that we can actually not just stop the destruction, but there are many ways in which we can actually still, even now, turn it around. You know, if you think about climate change, not just the carbon numbers, but think about it as representing massive ecosystem degeneration on a planetary scale that goes together with massive human system deconstruction, you know, with the social breakdowns and the economic breakdown, then the counter to it isn't just about limiting carbon, though we certainly have to do that. The counter is massive ecosystem regeneration. And the good news is that is perfectly possible to do. We know how to do that. We have some incredible examples around the world where that has been done on a large scale and a vast scale. And it can be done amazingly quickly. Doesn't necessarily have to take centuries. It can be done within years and with decades. You can turn a system around. We have the capacity to bring ourselves back from this brink of destruction and actually create a world that would be more beautiful, more fair, more healthy, and more pleasurable. So it's about changing our way of thinking and learning those tools that can help us figure out how to take carbon out of the atmosphere safely and bring ourselves back from this precipice. So permaculture was started back in the 70s by two Australians, Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. Bill was teaching at the University of Tasmania. He was an environmental science teacher. David was his graduate student. They were running around looking at the rainforests in Tasmania and asking, how come nobody has to go out here and prune these rainforests? Nobody has to spray them for bugs or fertilize them or anything. They completely take care of themselves. And yet they're this tremendously productive ecosystem. Would it be possible for us to produce food for humans in the same way a forest produces itself? To do agriculture with systems that could provide their own fertility, their own pest control, their own sustainability, and use less outside inputs and less human labor and maybe more human observation and intelligence and design and planning. Permaculture draws on a wealth of indigenous knowledge from around the world on traditional farming techniques, and it puts them together with more modern science and understanding. I think it's a tremendously powerful system. It also has an ethic: care for the earth, care for the people, care for the future, by limiting our consumption and by returning our surpluses into the system itself. When I discovered permaculture, it came after decades of being involved in earth-based spirituality. And I had come to that out of being an activist, out of caring about both social justice and environmental and ecological justice, and feeling like that had to be rooted in something deeper than just an intellectual understanding. It needed to also be rooted in our deeper emotional, spiritual, heart connection to the earth and to other human beings. So for me, it was always about believing our culture needs a shift in consciousness and reclaiming, which is the spiritual network, the community that I'm part of and helped to found. In our mission statement, we talk about wanting to create a new culture and to shift this culture from its path of destruction. So discovering permaculture was like, oh, this is the practical application. This is the how-to part. We've got the rituals down and we've got a lot of work on the history and the mythology and the understanding of how we got into this mess. And this is really, you know, hands in the dirt ways of taking those ideas and those principles and making them real.
Let me back up for just a minute around some of this context. I'm connected with a community that is disparagingly known as the Doomer community. And they would argue that we're not on the brink, we're already over the cliff. And I would argue back again that that does not negate the applicability or the relevance of permaculture, specifically social permaculture. I don't think there's anything permaculture is pointing to that would not be of benefit, whether we have a week, a year, a decade, a century, or a millennium. It doesn't really matter to me. According to evolutionary biology, extinction is the rule, not the exception. And it's not ours to know when that's going to happen, or to prevent that from happening, for that matter. If it's time to go, I would like to go gracefully. And the other thing is the idea of turning it around. There are no guarantees that even if everyone wakes up tomorrow morning and decides that we should do these things, there are no guarantees that it will turn around. And I can't imagine that happening anyway, as much as there are some marvelous examples around the world of things being turned around, there are also even more enormous examples of things being exacerbated. And if all things exist in balance, as I believe they do, then the more progress we make on the one hand, the more regression we're going to see on the other. And there's going to be this tension that we're going to have to learn to live with.
Let me speak to some of those. First, I would say to people who believe we're already over the cliff, that may well be true, but the question might also be, how high is that cliff? We are definitely over the tipping point as far as amount of carbon in the atmosphere. On the other hand, there are many, many ways we can pull carbon out of the atmosphere, and the ways we're talking about are not things like massively expensive carbon capture from coal, which is both incredibly stupid and impractical. We're talking about bringing carbon out of the atmosphere in the way nature has done it for hundreds of millions of years, using plants and building soil that is high in humus, which is soil organic carbon. The world's soils have an enormous carbon debt from thousands of years of agriculture, and particularly from the last 100 years of industrial agriculture. So when you talk about bringing things back into balance, we are so overbalanced in that carbon hunger that there's enormous room for bringing carbon out of the atmosphere rebuilding our soils. And the wonderful thing is that that has no negative consequences like some of the bizarre geoengineering schemes do. In fact, all of its, you know, extraneous consequences are positive and beneficial in other ways. It helps regulate the soil's water holding capacity. It increases the soil fertility. It increases the soil's ability to hold together and resist erosion, so we're not losing topsoil. Because it increases the soil's fertility, it also increases the nutrition in the plants. It can allow farmers to raise animals in ways that actually regenerate the grasslands and keep them from desertifying. It involves things like planting food forests and perennial systems that not only produce food for humans, but produce a whole lot of other environmental benefits for the soil and for the wildlife and for the whole ecosystem. And looking at all of those things and how they work together into systems, you know, it's not like here's the one Band-Aid formula you apply everywhere. It's the thing about nature and about living systems is you have to look at where you are and what the particular soil and climate and weather patterns and economic patterns are and craft something that fits into that niche very elegantly. But there's enormous capacity in the world for doing that. And in doing that, we bring the world back into a system that's far more in balance. Now, there's absolutely no guarantee this is going to, nothing's going to stop climate change at this point. But the same things that we need to do to try to bring us back from the brink are exactly the same things we need to do to mitigate it or to soften the fall if we're over the brink. It depends on how high that cliff is. There's no guarantee we can limit the rise to 2 degrees centigrade. But if we go over 6 degrees centigrade, then we're talking not just about storms and ocean rise and the other catastrophes. We're talking about destroying the basic oxygen balance of the planet, a planet without breathable air. So that's not even just human extinction. That's massive, massive life extinction. You know, I think we have an obligation to do everything we can to pull us back from that brink. And we're not over that brink yet. But there's a Native American proverb that goes, if we don't change our ways, we're going to wind up where we're headed. And if we don't change our ways, that's definitely where we're headed. The problem in this is not the science. And it's not the technology, and it's not knowing what to do. We know what to do, and we have all the tools and hands to do it. The problem is political. It's getting the political will to do it. So in order to get that political will, people have to know that it is possible to make these changes, and that making these changes again, it doesn't require enslaving half the world or destroying major ecosystems. That's what the old system requires. What it requires is actually doing the same things that are going to benefit people and land and wildlife and everything else in so many different ways. I think it's important for people to understand that, because that's what gives us the motivation to do the work we need to do to make sure it does happen.
All over the world, the waters are breaking. Everywhere, everywhere, the waters are breaking.
And so we turn, return, return, return to the mother. And so we turn, return, return, return to the mother. And so we turn.
Return to the mother.
All over the world.
Okay. So with that being said, let's go ahead and move on to the Earth Activist Training.
Yeah. So the Earth Activist Training was something that I started together with a wonderful woman and co-teacher named Penny Livingston Stark, who's a very brilliant permaculture designer and teacher. And we were looking at the permaculture community and saying, here's all these people that have these great solutions to so many different things, but how do we get them implemented? And then we were looking at the activist community going, here's all these people on fire with this desire to change the world, but who don't always know what to change it into. What if we put these together? So we started a permaculture training that also includes training in organizing and activism and in what we've come to call social permaculture, the patterns of human interaction and behavior that we need in order to create groups that are healthy and functional and has a grounding in spirit, in practice, in the things we need to do to sustain ourselves and sustain our own sense of energy and optimism. We've been doing these since I think the year 2000, so it's at 17 years now. For the last 5 or 6 years, we've also been offering diversity scholarships for people of color and differently abled people so that we can help both bring the tools to the communities that are really on the front lines of struggle and also help diversify the permaculture movement itself and make sure that it's a very broad-based movement.
Yeehaw! Like chicken or rare roast beef, whether garnished with booze or with keef. In the cannibal game, we'll all taste much the same, regardless of hue or belief. Yeehaw!
For me, I find it tremendously satisfying and exciting to be training people and see people come through our courses and kind of come out as these like engines of ecological excitement and knowledge and enthusiasm and go out and start wonderful projects and do some really amazing and incredible things. When you start doing something that works, then it works. So our scholarships generate more and more requests for scholarships, which it's wonderful that there's so much interest. You know, in our upcoming course, we have, I think, 5 people coming on scholarship that were water protectors from Standing Rock. We have kids from the inner city who are coming. We have young people who really want to farm and want to do this work of regenerating the landscape on a large scale and want to be trained and have the knowledge in how to do that. So, of course, it's just a beginning. It's only 2 weeks, but I think it's a great beginning for starting to understand how all these different aspects fit together into systems. And in very practical ways, changing our way of thinking to start looking at how do we design not this element or that element, but how do we actually design relationships between things and ways that things work together and reinforce each other. And those are powerful tools that aren't just about gardening. We can apply that same shift in thinking to a business or to a political action or a social movement.
So as I watch your video promotions on YouTube, I'm impressed not only with the diversity of your participants, but with the diversity of your instructors. Would you talk a little bit about your team?
Yes. So in our upcoming training, we have myself. I have a wonderful teacher named Charles Williams, who has a background in wilderness teaching and training and learning and in animal management, ranch management. He also manages my ranch, and he's a really beautiful and brilliant person when it comes to really understanding how all of these rural and land-based systems can actually work. And we're teaching it on the land of a wonderful woman named Nancy Clem, who is an expert in compost and composting systems. And she actually travels all over the world working with people and teaching composting and soil building. So we're very much looking forward to working with her and deepening our own knowledge of those systems. We also cover things in the training, you know, everything from mushrooms and microorganisms and all the things that go into building healthy soil. We talk about water management and how you can actually design your land to capture and hold and retain water. Or if you have the kind of land that has too much water, how you can move that water through the land and put it into places where it's going to do good. You know, we also talk about plants and food forests and how you can design companion planting and perennial systems, forestry management, energy systems, a natural building. So it's kind of, in a way, it's like a little taste of all of these aspects of sustainability with a focus on how do they all come together and support each other. We start every day with a morning practice and a ritual. We have time for people to really connect in to some of their deep sense of spirit. And we also do a lot of focus on how do we then take these things and organize around them and get them put into place. We have a whole section on urban permaculture. How do we take these ideas and apply them to our cities? Mm-hmm. You know, not just growing food in the cities, but seeing the city again as like a living ecosystem, and how do we make that a healthy and thriving one that actually works for people. Permaculture design course offers a certificate, which in the permaculture world internationally is kind of like your high school diploma. It says that you have done the basic work. It opens doors into a lot of things, from opportunities for internships to opportunities for further training and more advanced training. I think a lot of people come to a permaculture course and get excited and see some aspect of it and kind of go, this is what I want to pursue. You know, maybe I fall in love with the natural building aspect and I then want to go and train more and intern and become a very, very skilled natural builder. You know, we have one student who fell in love with the mushrooms, went and studied with Paul Stamets, who's this amazing teacher, researcher, and has a great company called Fungi Perfecti. And then went back to school and got her doctorate in mycology. You know, we have other students who've gone off and started intentional communities or built farms or taken a bus and gone all the way into Mexico and Central America, you know, sharing culture and learning from people and teaching people. And another eco bus that went all around the country doing workshops and teaching people skills in sustainability. We've had students who started programs in everything from urban transformation to school gardens, to working with inner city kids and taking them out into nature. There's just a wealth of opportunities. And we have people who are older, even at retirement age, who take the course because they want to sort of reset themselves and say, what am I going to do for the next part of my life? It's a great way that in a relatively short period of time, you can learn a wealth of skills and tools and open up a whole lot of doorways into places that people may want to develop further.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
I'm particularly interested in the social permaculture aspect just because of my background and training and also my stage and age in life. What would be the advantage of picking up those skills in an earth activist training session rather than offering a class and using the empowerment manual as my text?
Well, we do actually have a training in social permaculture as well.
Oh.
Every spring, we do a five-day training in social permaculture. Some years, we also combine it with a facilitation training. This year, we also offered a sacred earth apprenticeship, which focuses more on the spiritual as well as the social, with a focus particularly on herbalism and plants. You know, somebody who really had no interest in any of the other aspects in a full earth activist training, and only wanted the social permaculture, might do well to just take a social permaculture training. And I also do shorter versions of it. I'm going to do a weekend training in Rowe, Massachusetts in September. It's going to focus on the social permaculture aspects. And I often do shorter trainings in some of that range from an evening to a weekend to a 5-day. And that's also a very good way to get a taste of what this is all about. But I also say for people who are interested in the full Earth Activist training that you shouldn't let age or physical ability stop you. Some of it is hands-on, but there's always a variety of hands-on things that can be done. We've actually had a student in a wheelchair a couple times take our training. For those of us who are a little bit older, there's always plenty of young people to carry the heavy rocks. And there's many, many different aspects of it that don't require, you know, immense amounts of physical strength or flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that young myself.
You're almost as old as me. So you keep dancing our way back to the spiritual aspect. But before I move into that, let's get to the bottom line request, the actual ask. What if I have some money and I want to sponsor a specific student to go through the Earth Activist training? How much would I need to send you in order to make that happen? And is there a way that I can find out who your applicants are and pick the one that is most in alignment with my intentions for the betterment of the planet?
A full scholarship is $1,600 at the very low end of the sliding scale.
And that's expenses and tuition, is that correct?
Yeah.
What a deal.
And everything for 2 weeks.
And I understand they eat really, really well.
Well, certainly in our California course, which we do every January, I have a dear friend who comes and cooks for us who's a brilliant cook. So we try to meet that standard and we try to provide good, healthy, organic food wherever we are. We also actually have a couple courses coming up in Europe this summer, including one in the south of France, in French Catalonia, in August. And I co-teach with a wonderful guy named Alfred Decker, who is an American but lives in Spain. Those courses are always a wonderful, wonderful experience for people who come over from the U.S. It's a chance to travel. Because we price them for European pocketbooks, they're much less expensive than the courses we run in the U.S.
Mm.
And I will say, you eat pretty well.
I think that acronym is no accident. Earth Activist Training. Eat! Yes, let's eat!
Yeah. In terms of our students, if people are interested in sponsoring a particular student, what we would say is like, are you interested in sponsoring someone who was a water protector at Standing Rock, or someone who's an inner city kid, or someone who is a middle-aged woman in transition? And then we will hook you up with a student, and we often have students who will kind of write a letter afterwards and talk a little bit about both what the training meant for them and also how they're putting the training to work.
That's great to have that clarity on how that might happen. But if I had that kind of money, I wouldn't want to just do that neoliberal thing and throw it at you and turn my back. You know, I would really want to be connected with what it is I'm supporting or who it is I'm supporting. So I appreciate that you can accommodate that impulse.
And I'll also say that since probably most of us don't have that kind of money, every little bit really, really helps. You know, even someone who throws in $5 or $10 or whatever it is you might have lying around, that's an enormous help when lots of people do that. That allows us to continue to do this work of bringing these tools and skills to people who are leaders in their own frontline communities.
So even if I can't support a student in full, even a small financial expression of my support does not go unnoticed.
No, it makes me feel good.
I hear that. Okay, well, that's good to hear. I think we can move on to the spirituality aspect now.
Partly it came when I was a young woman, I think out of a sort of feminist sense of looking around at the other patriarchal religions and going like, well, where's their place for me as a woman? You know, I was raised Jewish and have very strong connections to that tradition. But when I was a young woman growing up, there were no Jewish women who were rabbis or cantors or really anything other than, like, you know, the head of Hadassah, the women's sort of auxiliary, or maybe a Hebrew school teacher. Mm-hmm. So as I was involved in the feminist movement back in the 70s, we were looking at the question of religion, and also a lot of us were feeling a need for our own spiritual connection and started looking into, was there ever anything different? And what we discovered is that, yes, if you go back to the roots of civilization, pretty much anywhere on the planet, and even in Europe and the Middle East, what you find are cultures that had a spirituality and a religion that was centered on the earth and the living systems of the earth, and that most often saw that as a goddess, as the sacred life force that was honored and that was respected, and saw women and saw female images of the divine and the sacred as very, very central to their culture and their religion. Mm-hmm. That was like a revelation as a young woman. You know, it's like, oh, wow, I can see the sacred form that I can relate to, my women's body, with my own intuition and sensibilities, the values that women have carried in culture of nurturing and caring for things and sustaining and thinking about the next generation, that could be the core of spirituality. This is a really wonderful thing. I have to learn more about this. And as we learned in research, what we realized also was the reason in Western culture we're so separated from these traditions really goes back to the witch burnings, mm-hmm, in the 15th and 17th century, which were deeply, deeply connected with the destruction of the solidarity of the peasant class and the working class. You know, people don't know this history about Europe. But in the late Middle Ages, all through the Middle Ages, there were thousands and thousands of peasant rebellions against the nobles and the upper classes. There was a whole tradition of villages that had land in common and that, you know, made their own decisions together about how they were going to manage that land and protect that land and care for that land. And those traditions were destroyed right at that same time of the rise of early capitalism by the privatization of land and the enclosure of the commons. It was the same period when the colonization of the New World was taking place and the African slave trade was revving up. And all of that was a way that this new sort of economic system that we call capitalism was put into place. And to do that, it really required shattering the connections that the poor and the working class people had with one another. So the witch persecutions were a way of taking away women's power. You know, women actually had more autonomy and power in the early Middle Ages than they did in the late Middle Ages, taking away women's roles as healers, attacking the traditional healing knowledge and systems that had been carried on in Europe from indigenous times forward, herbalism and connection to nature, many of which form the basis of some of our medical knowledge today. Things like aspirin comes from willow bark, which traditional herbalists had used for thousands and thousands of years to relieve pain. So in Europe, it was like this war on women and traditional healing systems that leave us with this residue of fear around anything that's not a system of knowledge approved of by the authorities that might speak to our intuition or speak to something that goes beyond what can be measured and contained. And it was integrally bound up with the way that those same kinds of tools of force and brutality and terror were used against women, against indigenous people on this continent, against the Africans who were brought over as slaves to prevent people from combining together and rising up.
So what is it that we celebrate with the summer solstice? I am aware, astronomically speaking, that it is the longest day of the year. Why is that important, spiritually speaking?
The solstice is the longest day, shortest night of the year, and so it marks a turning point in the year. It's a time, you could say, when light reaches its peak, maximum, and then begins to descend into the dark again. So it's a time of culmination, of fulfillment. It's a great time for bringing things to fruition, but it also teaches a very important lesson. And that lesson is, in order to really harvest, we're going to have to let go. It's a time when the crops are growing and everything's growing, but to actually bring them to fruition requires moving into that other phase where the days are going to start to get shorter, where eventually the cold is going to come back or winter is going to come. So we can't hold on to things forever. We can't stay at the peak. You know, we can't endlessly expand. Life is a cycle and a rhythm. You know, if the light were to expand endlessly, that would mean the destruction of all life on Earth. Light has to be balanced by dark, day by night, summer by winter. I think that's an important economic lesson. You know, we have an economic system that requires this idea of endless growth and expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And we do well to learn from the summer solstice that actually that's an impossibility. Expansion can't continue to come by exploiting and extracting resources. We have to develop an economic system based on cycles and recycling and coming back into balance.
I love that.
It's a very joyful time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a time when things are flowering and some things are beginning to fruit. You know, we celebrate it with dancing and with bonfires. Many, many traditional cultures, it was a time for staying up all night, lighting bonfires, dancing around the fire, leaping over the fire, purifying with fire.
I am the fire that burns within your soul. I am the holy light that fills and makes you whole. I am the flame within that never dies. I am the sun that will ever arise. Power of the sun, honor you this night. Leap across the fire to keep all spirits bright. Power of the sun, fire in the night. Leave behind that which blinds to restore our sight. I am the fire that clears away the old. I am the holy light that guides you to your soul. I am the flame of love for which you yearn. I am the sun that will always return. Power of the sun, I honor you this night. Leap across the fire, keep all spirits bright. Power of the sun, fire in the night, leave behind that which blinds to restore our sight.
Well, I think you've hit on all of the basic elements now. I've been tracking that. You were very deep on soil, earth, and then switch over to air, and then to water. And now we've got fire in it. Of course, spirit has been underlying the whole thing. I'm engaged myself in some working. I have been for 3 months brewing my first ever batch of Florida water.
Oh.
And I've reached the final stage. All the ingredients are combined and they're up on the top shelf of my cabinet getting acquainted. And they lack only a final straining, first through a fine stainless steel mesh and then through a silk scarf.
Yeah.
And it'll be ready. And I wanted to ask you, we've got a new moon coming up, the solstice new moon coming up next Friday. And I'm wondering if that's an opportune moment or if I should wait until the following full moon.
I think it's a good time to do it on the new moon.
That was my instinct. But, you know, those tend to be more clandestine sort of procedures.
And also it's kind of like the completion of the old moon cycle and the beginning of the new.
Mm-hmm.
Like a good time to strain out all the stuff that doesn't belong there. And then starting its new life as Florida water on the new moon and the new solstice. That seems like a very good, potent, powerful time to do it.
All right. Well, thank you for that little piece of advice as my pagan mentor. I appreciate that. In my research online before this interview, several practitioners were suggesting the burning of mugwort. Now, I have some mugwort, and I'm wondering what you think of that practice and how to go about doing it in high-density subsidized housing.
Well, mugwort traditionally is used for dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
You could burn it, but you could also make a dream pillow with it. Just dry it and put it into a muslin bag, and maybe even with some lavender, and put it under your pillow at night to sleep on. Or you could steep it and make a tea with it and drink it before you go to bed.
You can drink it?
Yeah.
Okay. Mugwort lavender tea. That sounds great. That's right up my alley.
In Chinese herbalism, there's a Chinese mugwort that they make into moxa. They compress it into very dense form and then burn it when they're doing acupuncture.
Mm.
So maybe that's what they're thinking of. I haven't actually done that on my ranch. We are growing herbs and developing essential oils. We distill a lot of things. And my partner is an acupuncturist.
Oh.
But we haven't quite gotten around to making matzo yet. Although I do have a garden full of it that I planted one plant 20 years ago and it's taken over. It will grow really well in dry shade. So I think sooner or later we will get around to doing that.
As you were talking about the return of the cold, across the movie screen of my mind flashed a picture of you standing there in the freezing cold Thanksgiving weekend at Standing Rock. And I'm wondering if there's anything further that you'd like to share beyond what was in your blog entry.
Well, for me, going to Standing Rock was a tremendous experience. I was only able to be there for a very, very short time over Thanksgiving weekend. But, you know, as somebody who's been writing and teaching and saying for decades, spirituality and politics have to go together, it was amazing to go to Standing Rock and go into a place where that was just the absolute ground of everything. The sign on the entrance to the camp says, you're entering a place of prayer and ceremony.
Uh-huh.
People really saw the actions as enacted prayers. And there was such a strong commitment there to nonviolence, to reaching out even to people you might think of as the enemy and saying, we're doing this for you too. This is for you, for your children, for all of our children. We don't see you as objects to be hated. We see you. There's a strong tradition in Lakota culture that says everything is relatives. We're all relatives. Plants, the animals, the rocks, the trees, even those people who you might think are against you are actually your relations as well. I was able to participate in a women's action and a women's sweat and met some incredible people there. So it was really, truly an amazing experience. And I have to admit, I was quite terrified to go there because of the cold.
Yeah.
I was born in Minnesota, but I've lived in California since I was 9 years old. I didn't know how I was going to handle the freezing weather, but it wasn't actually that cold until the last night I was there. It started to snow heavily. And I actually was kind of lucky to be able to get out. I was almost snowed in with the van that I'd rented. But somebody better than me managed to get it, drive it out of the campground. I drove back and was able to get my flight and get home, which I unfortunately had to do. So the really, really cold weather didn't set in until after I had gone. But I have immense admiration for the people who stayed there through those blizzards.
Yeah. Can you compare and contrast your experience there with your experience, what, 5-6 years ago with Occupy? And then even before that with the anti-nuclear movement in Seattle?
Yeah, you know, I've been through many different mobilizations and movements in my life, from the Occupy movement to the global justice movement to the anti-nuclear movements back in the 70s. And what struck me at Standing Rock was, first of all, how strongly this was held as an indigenous space. This is an indigenous movement. It's an indigenous-led movement. That is the culture we want to establish, and we expect people coming in to respect that. Occupy was a great grand experiment that I guess we have to have every 40 years or so. What would the world be like if we had absolutely no boundaries whatsoever? This reminded me a little bit of some of the early hippie communes back in the 60s.
Yeah, when you said 40 years, that's where my head went too.
Yeah, and what you discover after a short time is like, well, if you have absolutely no boundaries whatsoever, it's not actually liberating to everybody. What it means is people who have the least regard for anybody else tend to dominate the culture. And we do need to have some boundaries, and we do need to have standards of behavior, and some things are actually not okay. At Standing Rock, there were very clear boundaries and expectations. It wasn't like everybody makes decisions here. It was like, this is a place where the elders make the decisions, and we need to actually get permission from the elders to do something. So that was very different, but for me, I felt very much like I'm here to show up and offer whatever support I can to this effort, but to really respect what we're hearing from the people who started it and who have been so committed to it and committed their lives to it, that it is indigenous-led, and to respect that culture and their way of doing things.
Do you think the mainstream Western privileged population is ready to hear that?
I don't know whether they're ready to hear it or not, but I think they're going to hear it, because I think one of the things that's happening right now is kind of a resurgence of the indigenous, both in the people who have lived that way and carry that heritage, but also for those people who have European heritage, that sort of resurgence of the deeply hidden and suppressed indigenous in all of us.
Thank you for that.
Because I think that is what we need in order to make this tremendous transition from a world based on extraction and exploitation to a world that comes back into balance.
Wow, that's really beautiful. The other thing I wanted to ask you specifically about is the Fifth Sacred Thing movie. What's the latest on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting moment to ask that, because there's some very exciting developments with it. You know, we have been looking for the right producer for a long time. And, you know, we're now in discussion with some people who I think would be tremendous. So keep your fingers crossed.
Will do.
And it's likely that it will actually be a TV series rather than a movie. Just in the way the industry has changed over the last few years, there's just much more scope and option in TV than in movies. And I think that would allow us to tell a lot more of the story.
True that.
You know, it would also, I think, allow us to have more of an impact because it would be around for a much longer time.
Okay. Why don't we take a moment to tell my listeners how they can get more information about you, sign up for your newsletter, find your blog, and all of that.
Yeah, you can find everything at my website, which is starhawk.org. And you can sign up there for my newsletter. You've got links to all the things I'm doing, my schedule for all the different kinds of workshops and talks and trainings. It's always there. You can also go to earthactivisttraining.org, find out more about our Earth Activist trainings. And I'm also on Facebook, Starhawk, one word. I have an author page. And on Twitter, @Starhawk17.
Okay, very good. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time on your birthday to meet with me and talk to our listeners here at Sequitur.
Well, thank you.
I want to wish you a wonderful day and a successful training.
Thank you very much.
A blessed passage through whatever is left of this life.
Thank you.
You know, you can't take it with you, we find. But the ending of all humankind means all trace we were here will soon disappear, so you can't even leave it behind. Yee-haw.
That's it for now. Loads of gratitude to Starhawk for her work in the world and for the consciousness she brings to it. To Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary. To Lisa Thiel for the song Lita or Litha. To Judy Gran and Wind Hags for the Return to the Mother chant, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.